This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Here from Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan, she has a big worry about the effect of deregulation on the internet.
Larger corporations out there, these enormous entities, will be able to take control of content and stifle creativity.
Madigan talks with GLT's Charlie Schlinker about net neutrality. On Cinco de Mayo 2017, the Western Avenue Community Center is expanding its Tamale Festival to honor the service of its Hispanic outreach director. Judy Valente has that story. And celebrate the 80th anniversary of one of Unit 5's former neighborhood schools. Eugene Field was converted to offices in 2004, but staff and families remember the school in a report from GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 4th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan is celebrating the 14th Amendment, passed in the wake of the Civil War. Adoption by rebel states was a prerequisite to regaining representation in Congress, but the amendment has grown far beyond its origins in the Restoration era. Madigan spoke to the McLean County Bar Association Wednesday and to GLT's Charlie Schlinker at Illinois State University's Bone Student Center. Madigan says not only is the amendment the theme for this year of the American Bar Association, it's also especially interesting given the issues before the U.S. today.
It's particularly appropriate, I think, at this point because of what's going on in our country. And so many of the debates that we're having involve fundamental issues in this country. And with all due respect to the Founding Fathers, sometimes, you know, we spend too much time, I think, focused on the period of American history after the American Revolution and not nearly enough time focusing on the time after the Civil War, Reconstruction. And it is really because of all of the challenges that the United States faced at that time that the 14th Amendment came about. But certainly, I don't think that the Republicans who were the ones moving the 14th Amendment through Congress at the time recognized or realized the scope and the importance that the amendment would come to have in our country.
Are you saying that there are particular threats to due process today that parallel this the time that this Restoration Amendment was passed?
Well, I think when you look historically at some of the most celebrated as well as the most controversial United States Supreme Court cases, you'll see that they are really, at their heart, 14th Amendment cases. And again, many of the issues that we're facing today, many of the issues that people thought were long settled, 40, 50 years ago, that are coming back up to be debated, at their core, ultimately probably going to be resolved by the judiciary based on their interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
Due process has been weakened by the courts in the arena of asset forfeiture over the decades. Is that a dangerous area to be extended to other people now?
Well, I think asset forfeiture is an interesting issue, but I think when you look at the issues that are the forefront in many people's minds these days, immigration, health care, even issues such as climate change, it is so difficult to, I think, explain to people the heightened importance that the judiciary has and the reliance that I certainly hope they have on the 14th Amendment when making decisions in these areas.
You recently signed on to a letter with other attorneys general opposing a weakening of FCC enforcement provisions on net neutrality. Why is that a good idea for state attorneys general to get into that thicket?
Well, I think it's very important that net neutrality remains. Basically, what we are trying to prevent is a situation where we don't continue to have an open flow of ideas, open access to information, because if net neutrality is eliminated, you will have certain companies who are able to either charge or control what information people can access. Also, be able to control whether new startups are able to get their information and get their businesses in some ways up and going. It's a very complicated issue that not a lot of folks understand, but the implications of what the FCC chairperson is interested in doing will be very far-reaching and potentially devastating to innovation and ideas.
His claim, though, is that less regulation will encourage more infrastructure to be built. Are we still in that part of the life cycle of this new technology, or is the regulation going to protect the little guys? What's the give and take?
The regulation, making sure that net neutrality exists, will allow the little guys to continue to exist. Otherwise, you really will stifle competition because the larger corporations out there who've become, you know, just these enormous entities will be able to take control of content and really of and stifle creativity. I think that there's a lot that is still out there to be done. Technology is changing rapidly, but one of the reasons it's able to change rapidly and those ideas come to life has been because of net neutrality, and it could very much change if the rules change.
What about building the infrastructure, though? That's the building the pipes. That's what the FCC chairman is saying should be protected.
Well, same way, right? What the FCC chairman is saying and what this rule will really do are not always the same thing. And so part of the concern is making sure that others are still able to enter in and to be able to have their businesses and be competitive. I don't think, and many others agree, that what the FCC chairman is trying to do will change that.
The book called The Master Switch by Tim Wu charts the life cycle of regulation and development of new communications technology. From the telegraph to the telephone, to movies, the life cycle, he says, is always the same. You get these little startups, you get regionals, you get monopoly, you get breaking up the monopoly, and then the monopolies reassemble themselves. Where are we in that life cycle here?
Well, look, you bring up a good point. What I can tell you is that what we're looking at right now are number of companies that through merger and acquisition have gotten larger and larger. And so we're very much at a point where startups and others, the smaller entities, are facing much more of a challenge when it comes to entering the market. And that is the biggest concern about ultimately what happens vis-a-vis net neutrality.
This is not a new fight for Madigan. She's on record with the FCC when net neutrality rules were first adopted. The current proposal would preserve the principle of net neutrality, but Madigan and others say it would gut the commission's ability to enforce anything. Madigan spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker at ISU's Bone Student Center after her Law Day address yesterday to the McLean County Bar Association. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
May 5th is Cinco de Mayo, when members of the Mexican community marked the victory of Mexico over French occupying forces in 1862. The Western Avenue Community Center this year is expanding its annual Cinco de Mayo Tamale Festival. It's also celebrating 25 years of service of its Hispanic outreach director, Socorro Alvarez. Alvarez came to this country in the mid-70s on a student visa, but some of her family members arrived undocumented. She tells GLT's Judy Valente she has firsthand knowledge of the struggles many immigrants face.
I know how it is to be here when you don't know the language, when you don't know the culture, and you don't know where the resources are in the community.
You mentioned issues about language, issues about culture, understanding the culture. Give me some specific examples.
Someone that, a family that rents an apartment, and then they live there for 5-6 years. Then they leave the apartment, and later on they receive a statement saying that they own $800 or $1,000 because they painted the apartment, because they had to clean the carpet. So they don't know that some of those things are part of the owners. I mean, they have to replace. They don't have to pay for paint or for maybe for cleaning the carpet, but for some things, they don't have to pay for that. And they get scared. And sometimes they do pay, and sometimes they come to us before they pay. What do I do? I have this big bill, and I don't think it's fair, but they don't know. They don't have to pay for that paint or things like that.
I think what you're saying is it's easy for some people, who landlords or other business owners or employers who are unscrupulous, to take advantage of people who are unfamiliar with the language. I think that's what you're saying.
Correct. Yes.
What are some of the individual stories that stay with you?
I remember a mom that I helped. She had 4 or 5 children. She came to me wanting to know how to get a birth certificate for her daughter.
Was her daughter born here?
The child was 7 years old. And I said, well, where was she born? She said she was born when she was crossing the desert.
Mm.
So she couldn't make her a citizen of here, and she 7 years has passed, so they had to go back to Mexico and register there as a Mexican citizen. So that, I thought it was horrible, you know, to give birth in the middle of the desert.
I understand you helped a woman whose father was American and who really, because of bad advice, didn't know that she could get American citizenship. And finally, you helped her to get American citizenship at the age of 50.
This lady, her father was born in Texas somewhere. And then he went back to Mexico. He married there, had his family. When he was there, he tried to apply for citizenship for the children. But unfortunately, because of the person who assisted him didn't do the right thing, it didn't go through, or something happened that the kids didn't get their citizenship. So then later on, the children, when they were adults, they came undocumented to this country. And she navigated for more than 20, 30 years with different attorneys in Texas, here in Chicago. And nobody could help her, and she's been working undocumented. She couldn't go back to Mexico to see her family. So many issues that she had to face because of that. Finally, she went to Immigration Project,
which is right here in McLean County.
And so they were able to help her to put the paperwork together. They told her that she was going to go receive her certificate in Chicago. However, you know, being undocumented is, they're scared to, some families are scared to drive to Chicago. So she's not familiar with the city. So she asked if I can go with her, and we went there, and they did a ceremony.
Why do you think you understood her problem when evidently years had passed and no one really realized how to help her?
When families come to me and they have issues, like I said, immigration issues that I cannot help them with, I refer them. So I knew exactly where to refer her for that, and they were able to help her. I help her with other things like you know, find employment or finding a mobile home and help her, you know, with other issues that she had. But the Immigration Project helped her with that, becoming a citizen.
I'm also told that you have a special passion for Ballet Folklorico de Central Illinois. What is the ballet, and what's your role, and why do you love it so much?
Oh, it's when I was little, at school, I used to do those dances.
Traditional dances.
And so I just, it reminds me of my home country. So I love to see the kids dance and have fun and learn also about the culture. And so when the Conexiones Latinas asked us if we can let them practice at our facility, I said, sure. I've been wanting for somebody to organize a group like this.
And you stay late, I understand. You stay late at the center beyond your hours that you're paid for so that the center can be open and they can come there and practice.
Correct. Yes.
It's that important to you.
It is important to me. And I know they're doing something good, you know, something good for the community so the community can enjoy their dancing. Because it reminds me of me when I was little.
Another project that you are involved with is Kinder Music. That is a bilingual program for children and their moms. Tell us about Kinder Music and why that's so dear to your heart.
Families feel comfortable coming to our center. They come once a week, but the...
What do they do exactly?
They dance. Since it's music, they dance. They to help them develop their brain through the music.
And what does it do for the moms?
The moms also learn the words that the teacher has the words in English and Spanish. And the moms learn, get to learn English and also socialize because some of the mothers are at home moms and they don't have other place to go socialize.
Now, this is tough work that you do. People come to you with problems every day. What gets you up in the morning and going to work?
I just love my job. I love helping people. I know sometimes it's challenging because I don't know the answer to their problems, but it makes me, look for
solution?
The solution, yes. Yeah. So I just love to serve people because at one time, you know, when we came, there was no assistance at all for the Spanish-speaking families in the community. So I just, it's very dear to my heart to help the families.
How does the rhetoric about build the wall, Mexicans are bad hombres, rapists, murderers, how does that make you feel, someone who knows the Mexican-American community intimately?
Well, it's hurtful. I mean, it's not, I don't agree with what he's saying because not everybody is, you know, rapist or bad person. You know, we all different, but in our community, we have lots of good people, and we are good people. So it's very uncomfortable.
If you had 5 minutes with President Trump, what would you want to communicate to him about the Mexican community?
To give the opportunity to the families that are here just working and trying to make a living, and they are not, you know, they haven't committed any crimes or anything. So to give them an opportunity to stay here and make their home here so they can live happily and live the American dream.
We've been talking with Socorro Alvarez. She is celebrating 25 years with Western Avenue Community Center as their Hispanic Outreach Director. Thanks so much, Mrs. Alvarez, for coming in and talking.
Thank you for the invitation.
I'm Judy Valente.
The Western Avenue Community Center holds its Cinco de Mayo celebration from 5 to 11 p.m. at the Plumbers and Pipefitters Union Hall in Bloomington. In addition to handmade tamales and tacos, there will be folk dancing and strolling guitarists. Tickets are available on the center's website. In addition to honoring Socorro Alvarez, the center will also recognize the service of two other Hispanic outreach workers. Saul Pulido has been a translator at the center since 2002, and Liz Acevedo Alstrom has been a bilingual counselor since 1988. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. Numerous groups are pushing for ordinances in Bloomington Normal to lessen the fear felt by some people Socorro Alvarez helps. They want a welcoming cities designation similar to a sanctuary city in refusing cooperation with federal immigration authorities. One of the full-throated voices in favor of an ordinance is local historian Greg Coos, retired director of the McLean County Museum of History. During the rally and march on Bloomington City Hall this week, Coos constructed a logical proof using historical data to rebut common objections to an ordinance, that it would break the law, that Latinos are different than other immigrant groups, that the door should be closed now when it was not in other eras. Here's Greg Coos at the rally.
Fact. We are all immigrants.
That's right.
Yeah. Fact. The land this community was built on was taken from the Kickapoo people.
That's right.
Fact. All whites in this community were immigrants.
Yes.
Fact. Most blacks in this community had ancestors who were slaves. They didn't ask to come to America.
That's right, sir.
That's right.
Fact. 40% or more of people of this community 100 years ago were either born in Germany and Ireland or had parents who were born in Germany and Ireland. 40%. Fact. The German people here worked hard to keep their German language. They started churches, newspapers, businesses, and a school which exclusively used the German language. Fact. People of European descent often say, my family came here legally. Yes, they did, because they were needed for cheap labor. Fact, immigrants are welcome when people with money want cheap labor. Fact, Germans and Irish were cheap labor. And so were later immigrants, like Chinese, Japanese, Scandinavians, Hungarians, Italians, and Greeks. Fact, Latinos became the cheap labor for America when the people with money stopped the poor Europeans from coming here. Fact, Latinos without documents are being treated much like slaves. Their presence is illegal, like a free black was illegal before the American Civil War. Fact, to treat an illegal like a slave is to steal his and her labor, to tear apart their families and terrorize them with random arrest.
That's right.
Fact, 170 years ago, people in this state worked to stop slavery by breaking the law. They were aided by the fact that many local governments ignored the laws dealing with slaves who had escaped. Fact, the welcoming cities ordinance is a gentle and legal step towards securing freedom for our families and our neighbors.
Local historian Greg Coos speaking outside Bloomington City Hall in favor of a welcoming cities ordinance. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A classic thriller jumps from the screen to the stage in the latest production of Community Players. Based on the film by Alfred Hitchcock, 39 Steps takes a comedic twist in the footlights, but it still has Hitchcock's fingerprints all over it. Laura Kennedy has more.
The 1934 Hitchcock film, The 39 Steps, follows the adventures of a man falsely accused of murder who must evade the police and foreign agents in turns.
Now, Mr. Haney, I suppose it's safe to call you by your real name now? What about our mutual friend, Annabella?
She's been murdered.
Murdered? Oh, the Portland Mansions affair. What our friends outside are looking for you for?
I didn't do it.
Of course you didn't. But why come all this way to Scotland to tell me about it?
I believe she was coming to see you about some Air Ministry secret. She was killed by a foreign agent who was interested too.
This classic tale comes to Community Players starting this weekend. Scott Myers is the director, and true to the spirit of the play, where few actors play many roles, Bruce Parrish is not only a performer in the show, but a scenic designer and part of the stage crew. Hitchcock's film version of The 39 Steps is now considered a minor classic thriller, but the stage play is something different altogether. Well, the plot is still the same. A bored man meets a woman who claims to be a spy, and when he takes her home, she's murdered, and the man is forced to flee with a mysterious organization known as The 39 Steps hot on his trail. Bruce Parrish says what sets the play apart from the film is the wildly comedic twist to the material, plus the fact that the actors play multiple roles.
So it's a comedy, not the thriller, but it's the same dialogue. It just depends on how you say it.
And there's not a huge range of actors doing this. You've got a huge range of characters.
Correct. We have four main characters. So Jeff Reedy, who plays our main character, Richard Hannay, and he pretty much plays Richard throughout the entire thing. He doesn't have that many costume changes. It's basically the same setup. And then we have Maggie O'Brien, and she is playing three different female characters from the show. We have a spy, really. She's German and a spy and has fun with that. And then she's actually murdered.
Spoiler alert.
A spoiler alert there. She proceeds then to be a Scottish wife of a crofter, they call them, the farmer in Scotland, and finishes up as Margaret, who just a fun part for her. She just really plays and does a nice job, I think.
Well, Bruce, you play a lot of roles in this backstage and as well as a radio announcer. So you are off stage reading lines, but you're a voice through a radio.
Actually, we went in and we recorded it.
Oh, okay.
So that it could be played while we're moving things. I mean, it's
because you're
it
actually on
purpose.
Stage moving
yes,
while
so,
your voice is
yes.
coming over.
Otherwise, you would, well, how does he do that? That's magic.
You really have to put it out there in order to do this show because it's fast moving and it's some crazy choreography. It's almost farce-esque.
It really is. You know, we had made the comment just the other night at one of the rehearsals. We have the advantage sometimes of doing a straight play. You don't have to deal with music. You don't have to deal with choreography. However, when we get to the train scene and we have two gentlemen that play a porter and a newspaper boy and an old lady and police officers, they just change with hats and turn and it's immediate and quickly done. Well, that had to be almost choreographed so that it came through the way we wanted it to happen.
Scott, how are you helping your actors play these multiple roles? And some of them are just seconds apart as they're performing.
They really are. And so often actors want to really get into their role and they have to, you know, take time. There's no time for this. And so we really stressed our actors to grab hold of these different characters. Of course, we want you to watch 39 Steps, the Alfred Hitchcock movie. That's important to get that premise. And then from there, really build your characters. I said, if I close my eyes, I shouldn't think, oh, that is the same character that I'm listening to. They should all be different. And they do an excellent job. Alex Knightwright and Brian Artman are the two what we call comedians. And they truly have multiple performances that they do on stage. Just great, great actors.
Well, how do you balance the comedy with maybe the sort of thriller moments of this play and keep the balance there?
It's kind of unexpected. That's what's fun about this show. You just never know what you're going to get. You feel like you're getting into the story and it feels like that thriller and the mystery is happening and all of a sudden you hear a rim shot or there's a play on words that you know makes people laugh and quite honestly, we jump through different decades too. You might hear some music that I will say not probably 1930s music. We start the show with that kind of music as people are coming in, and you'll see it here and there throughout the show, but watch for some surprises musically as well.
So we have basically sort of a Python-esque impression on some Hitchcock here. A lot of people are very familiar with Hitchcock, and this is an adaptation of his 1934 film. Are you making Hitchcock references throughout the play?
Oh, throughout. In fact, we were just talking coming here. We have a few birds stationed around the set. And of course, if you're a Hitchcock fan, you're going to catch all kinds of things. Maybe it's the way someone, you know, they might reference the word Rebecca, or you might hear psycho, you know, music. So if you are a Hitchcock fan, Watch and listen. I think you're going to catch all kinds of things that'll put a smile on your face for sure.
Does the audience actually have to be familiar with the film, The 39 Steps?
Not at all. It really tells a nice story here, right from the beginning to the end. So you may not be familiar with the Hitchcock film, but I often say if you like live theater, which I love live theater, if you like Hitchcock, if you like mystery and suspense, if you like comedy, if you just want to come for a great afternoon or evening at the theater. And, you know, that's really what theater is. It's escape. And so, no pun intended, as yes. Hannah is escaping, trying to get away from police officers throughout the show. But it really is an escape. And that's what I want. My goal was to have audiences come in and escape the world out there and jump into this world of Hitchcock and England and Scotland and all the different places we are at and just laugh and have fun. That's really what we want to accomplish.
Bruce, with such a fast-moving show and a lot of moving parts within that show. Mm-hmm. Have you had any, because I know there is a train involved in this show. Have there been any train wrecks in rehearsal that have been particularly amusing?
Sometimes just trying to get one off and one on. We move the train and the bridge has to come in and it's just like zoom, zoom. There's so many platforms that if something is parked next to the other way too close, you get that rubbing of the wood and the screeching. And so you get sound effects you didn't anticipate happening. But so far, most of the things, the idea of the set, it's in this old theater. And so there are stage boxes that we built for Man of La Mancha back in 2001. Okay. There are pieces. There are tools from the shop.
Almost like people looking behind the curtain.
It's definitely. And sometimes they will. As the curtain opens, they'll see backstage.
And they'll look all the way in through and go, oh, that must be their shop.
So it's wearing its theatricality as a badge of honor.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A great honor. Yeah. And a tip of the hat to community players, too, as we performed through the years and put great productions on there. So it's going to allow the audience to use some of their imagination as well, because you're not going to have these massively full sets ready as the curtain opens. It's a little piece of this and a little piece of that and a door that turns, and you can use your imagination to fill in the pieces.
You know, I've been backstage at Community Players, and I've seen the copious amount of props and everything that you have from your past 90 years. You must be pulling out things all the way dating many, many years back.
Our oldest prop was from, like, the 1923-24 season, the first full season that they performed, but it didn't make it on stage. Sometimes we like to get those things on stage, but there is a unique piece on stage that hasn't been on stage since, and I won't remember the year, and I'm supposed to do that as the historian, but it was from I Hate Hamlet, and it's a comedy. It was like in the late 90s.
What is the prop? What should we be looking for?
Oh, you can't miss him,
you
sir.
Can't miss it. That's all we'll say. We don't want to give everything away.
Yeah,
not all spoilers.
Especially if you get to see it, you want to be surprised, because you will, being a Hitchcock fan, you'll appreciate some of the quick one-liners that cover some of the different films.
This sounds like a very demanding play. Scott, when you were casting this, were you looking for a particular stage chemistry between the actors?
I think so. We're really looking at ensemble acting here when you've got a small group, unlike when you have a full musical with lots and lots of people. These characters have to gel. They have to blend. I told them, referring to radio, it's almost like dead air is our enemy.
Yeah.
We cannot have that. So when we go from one thing to another, it has to be a smooth transition. And in order to do that, they have to almost read each other's minds at times. Yes, if somebody drops a line, oh my word, pick up quickly and go with the flow, and everybody's able to do that. We have an outstanding group of actors that I'm just very, very thrilled to have an audience see together. And in this show, if something goes wrong, it's okay.
It actually works.
It fits the kind of style of show that we have. So that takes a little bit of pressure off, although I still, I'll know if something wasn't done right.
That's Scott Myers and Bruce Parrish from Community Players. The 39 Steps has a preview tonight, opens officially tomorrow, and runs through the 14th at the theater on Robin Hood Lane in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The producers of 39 Steps say this is a family-friendly show and good for all ages. You're listening to the opening title music from the 1934 Hitchcock film. It's Sound Ideas. Thank you. Coming up, you'll hear about a couple of good reasons to spend time at the Ball Diamond this weekend. That's ahead during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. When one of Unit 5's last true neighborhood schools, Eugene Field Elementary, was converted for special education offices in 2004, the neighborhood lost an anchor. The school, named for poet Eugene Field, cost $45,000 to build, and it represented an extended family with many veteran staff and teachers, including Melba Jean Frink, who holds the record for having taught 31 years there. As Eugene Field marks an 80th anniversary this weekend, GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talked with two staff members, Jane Collins and Susie Zink, who have been part of the rebirth of the building for when state funding ended for the McLean County Occupational Development Center in 2009.
We were given a corner of this building, and the next year, the superintendent gave us the entire building. So that first full year was vocational training center, and then other programs have come in since.
What are some of those other programs now?
We have the vocational training center, which still was the primary focus. That serves students at Normal Community and Normal West, 9th through 12th grade, that need intensified vocational skills. We also since have brought in what's called our 18 to 21 transition program. That's for students that have attended Normal Community and Normal West for 4 years, and they come over to us for the majority would be 3 more years up until the day before their 22nd birthday. Life skills training on linking them to services to be more independent in the community. We also have housed here our adapted learning program. The students enrolled in that program are taught the same academic curriculum as students at Community and West. They are students that are still considered enrolled in Community and West. They just have a more individualized program, working on some emotional aspects of their life to be able to function.
So this building is really thriving and probably full most of the regular school day, right?
We're bursting at the seams. I have here Susie Zink. She's new to our district 3 years ago and had a real need for our severe population. The state of Illinois, when students exit, these are our students that would be transitioned to developmental training programs. We needed someone to focus specifically on this population, but then we also have a whole group of kids that easily transition from that into employment, and they just needed Susie to develop some programs for them, and I have her here today.
Susie, I just want to ask you quickly about the kinds of things that you're doing for that targeted group of students, just so we have a better understanding of how you're helping them kind of make the transition to the world of work.
We have students that come here for their work program either in the morning or afternoon. They work on amping up their vocational skills, everything from following a simple schedule to vocational work task boxes that are assembling faucets, sorting by colors, by shape. I also have a set of students that actually go out in the community and work, and they go out with a job coach, partnered with several places out in the community. They go out and they do a fabulous job, just kind of whatever they need to start with their basic educational skills and amp them up. Our 18 to 21 program, they have half of the day of life skills, and then they have half of the day of vocational training also. So many of them go out in the community and work most afternoons. In the morning with their life skill stuff, they focus on basic life skill stuff, how to make a budget, how to follow a budget, going grocery store shopping, cooking the meals. We have an apartment set up in one of our classrooms downstairs that has a bedroom, a kitchen, a dining room, a family room. It's just kind of like how an apartment would be. And they work a couple times a week down there on focusing on those apartment skills and being on their own.
They spend an entire month over at Heartland, and they're learning the campus and navigating how to independently find a class if you were to take classes there.
So all needed services being housed in this building. And you don't always see older schools that were shuttered kind of repurposed in that way. So it's kind of exciting.
I like to think that we have brought this neighborhood back to life. I'm very vested in the Fell Park Neighborhood Association. They're a great group of people. Some of the members of that have been on our 80th anniversary committee.
You're listening to Sound Ideas, and I'm Colleen Reynolds talking with Jane Collins, who is administrator of the secondary Secondary Services and Vocational Training Center at the former Eugene Field Elementary School. Also joining us is Susie Singh, who's in charge of developmental training there. Both of these ladies have been involved in planning the 80th anniversary for the building. So some people might ask, why take time and put all that energy into celebrating an anniversary for a building?
That's easy. You should never forget who came before you. The history that is within Eugene Field is, I can't even think of the words to share with you. It's so rich, and it's such a big part of our community. Many people attended Eugene Field. Our students deserve the recognition, and so do the people that used to go to school here. We'll be giving tours. The committee decided there are many people that can't come during the day. We're having an open house in the evening. We're having a cakewalk because Susie Zink thought that'd be a great idea. And then the Fell Park Neighborhood Association has opened up their pavilion on Saturday, and Susie's putting together our memory book. So on our Facebook page, we have a link for people to submit memories. And I'm going to let you talk about one name in particular that keeps coming up.
Melba Jean Frink, who was a kindergarten teacher here forever. Her name has popped up more times than I can count. And I just posted on a Facebook page this morning that she is going to be here Friday. She has been a big part of planning all of this. I can't tell you how many likes I have on the page, and I just posted it an hour and a half ago. She will be here. Gloria Jamison is also going to be here. She was a third grade teacher here for over 22 years. Twyla Eckhurst is also going to be here. She started as a student. Her children all went through Eugene Field, and she was the last secretary before they shut the school down in 2004. She has been a big part of it. I don't know what we'd do without these three ladies. They are amazing.
We're honoring Reginald Whitaker, at 2:00. He was a fifth grade student the year that the school opened. He is an incredible man, very humble, very kind, and I can't wait to be able to give him this recognition. Well-deserved and overdue.
And he's 92,
is that? 92. He just celebrated his birthday.
So you mentioned a lot of important people went to Eugene Field. Are there some names we would recognize?
Former graduate Jay Blunk went to elementary school here. Jay has actually sent us from the Black Hawk Association some items to give out for people that come see us. We'll have lots of different things for sale. It is somewhat of a fundraising event also. We're fundraising for a future Eugene Field of Dreams.
So when you say Field of Dreams, I think of like baseball field. Am I off track there?
With the neighborhood being the age that it is, I have several students with physical disabilities who are in wheelchairs. It's difficult to get out and around, but we're wanting to have within the school grounds a wheelchair walkway path along with sensory garden for our students with autism, potentially an outdoor classroom. Just a really nice, safe environment for all the students in the building, and then also for the community.
So talk about the memories that have been coming in that you'll compile in the memory book. I know, Susie, that's a project you've been spending a lot of your time on.
It wasn't just a school. It was a safe place, and everybody felt like family here, and they all became extended family. Talking with Mrs. Frink, she said that you knew if you needed anything, anyone in the building would be here to help you.
GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds speaking with the organizers of the 80th anniversary celebration of Eugene Field School in Normal. See more photos and get a complete schedule of activities for the Eugene Field 80th Anniversary Celebration at our website, WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. More spring-like weather is on the way this weekend, and after lots of rain and wind, that's an opportunity to spend some time outside. Josh Remington is the Assistant Director of Marketing with ISU Athletics, and he has a couple of ideas for outdoor fun. Josh, thanks for stopping by to talk about America's favorite pastime, baseball, and one of my favorite pastimes, biking.
Absolutely. It's a great opportunity. And again, as you mentioned, this weekend, the weather's really shaping up for a great time out at the ballpark. Always all season long for both baseball and softball, free admission for all fans. So it's a great opportunity, especially as you mentioned this weekend.
Well, let's start with the Redbirds versus Indiana State Sunday at Duffy Bass Field. You're encouraging people to bike to the park on this day. What's going on?
That is correct. This is our second annual Pedal to the Park this year. So we have a number of things happening. No shared ride this year from Uptown Normal, but we do have a bike valet for those that choose to ride on their own.
Can you explain that real quick,
what that means? So basically, for those that bring their bikes out, it allows them to have a secure spot for their bike throughout the entire game. We'll have someone monitoring that area. They check in their bike when they arrive, and then they can pick it up at the end of the game and take it home with them.
So you don't have to bring a lock.
Less weight to pedal.
One less thing. Yeah.
Less weight to pedal around. Mm-hmm. Thanks to some bike sharing programs in the community, people can't really use the excuse of I don't have a bike.
That is correct. Yep, Bike Share 309 through Uptown Normal and the RegiRide system for students on campus. Both fantastic partners for us and great opportunities for those without a bicycle of their own to be able to get out to the ballpark.
Are you suggesting people take any particular route to get to the ballpark?
Really using the trails would be the best recommendation for us.
And the Constitution Trail.
Yeah, exactly. The Constitution Trail to get over to the ballpark there. There's some easy ways to get there through those routes.
The trail actually sort of winds its way through the ISU campus and goes mm-hmm. right behind the ball diamond. Then you would take it up Gregory and into the parking lot, and the bike parking is right there?
That's right. Yep, the upper parking lot there at the corner of Gregory and Adelaide. Yep.
There are some freebies for people who are riding their bikes. Is that right?
Absolutely. So once people arrive, we want them to make sure that they're refreshed once they get to the ballpark, get ready for some baseball. So we have free Gatorade available for those that ride their bikes, as well as free popsicles for all fans as well when they enter while supplies last. So a couple of good refreshing options there.
And some things for the kids going on Sunday as well. We'll get to Saturday, mm-hmm. but on Sunday, kids can get autographs and they can get down on the field, right?
That is correct. Yep. Most of our games actually offer post-game autographs, and Sundays will as well. So families are welcome to come out for that. And it is also a Jason's Deli Sunday Run Day, as we've coined it. So they can come down on the field after they get their autographs. They can run a lap around the bases just like their favorite Redbird players.
And is that for kids of all ages? What if I wanted to get down there and run the bases?
We might limit it at 12 or 15 or so.
Okay.
So sorry about you.
speaking of kids, Saturday is really geared for kids and families, and it's baseball and softball?
That is correct. Yep, this is the first time in a couple of years that we have combined the event between baseball and softball, but a great opportunity for both fan bases, and softball is doing well during the season as well. So
who's playing? It's it's the same team, Indiana State, for baseball.
That is correct.
What's going on? Playing softball?
Softball has a doubleheader beginning at noon on Saturday, and they're against Northern Iowa. So they'll start at noon, and the Kids Club event begins at 1 p.m.
Tell me about Reggie Kids Club.
Mm-hmm. Reggie's Kids Club is our free kids club for those 12 and under, and they have events throughout the year at most of our sports. We have a Kids Club day that allows for free entry or discounted tickets, as well as for those RSVP, things like free pizza, and for this game specifically, free ISU braided wristband or a bracelet that you can get upon RFUP.
And if they're not already in the Kids Club, can they join that day?
You can join that day or online at goredbirds.com. But yeah, we'll have plenty of opportunities for signups there at the site at Adelaide Street Soccer Field there where we're hosting the event prior to the game.
And if they want pizza, they have to register in advance.
That is correct. Yep. On goredbirds.com, you can register or call our marketing line at 309-438-3399, and that's through about noon tomorrow. We'll take RSVPs for that.
And besides face painting, lots of stuff mm-hmm. going on. What else? Is it inflatable? Is that right?
Yeah, there will have a obstacle course inflatable by Fun on the Run. They'll be coming out, as well as the Zoo Lady will be bringing her paint and coming out and painting faces for all the kids that would be interested there. So a couple of great things, as well as I mentioned, those for RSVP will be welcome to have their free pizza and the giveaway as well.
So mm-hmm. I'm not a big sports guy. How far are we into the season, and how is softball doing? How is baseball doing?
Softball is doing very well. They've been towards the top of the conference for most of the year. They can actually clinch this weekend if they were to win the appropriate amount of games. So that's a great opportunity for them. Baseball, we've got a younger crew this year. We had a lot of seniors last year, but they've definitely had a more exciting stretch here down the finish of the season. Just this past week, actually, against Milwaukee, they had a walk-off win late in the game. So
it's a really nice-looking facility there. It's at the corner of Gregory and Cottage. Mm-hmm. How old is that?
Gregory and Adelaide.
In 2009,
they finished the renovation there. So we have seating for just over 1,000 fans. Beautiful facility there. And our press box is new as well. So come on out, check out the stadium. New LED board within the last couple of year, and a couple other elements as well that we've added since then.
And again, run over the schedule again one more mm-hmm. time, Saturday and Sunday. What's going on?
So Saturday, doubleheader for softball begins at noon against Northern Iowa. The Kids Club event begins on the soccer field that is adjacent between the softball and baseball field. That begins at 1 p.m. with those Kids Club events. And at that same time, actually, is our Redbird for Life, our R.B. Farrell alumni get-together there for former professional baseball players coming from ISU. They're getting together to sign some autographs and things. That'll be going on at the same time. And then baseball begins at 2 on Saturday. And then we turn right around on Sunday with a 1 p.m. first pitch for Pedal of the Park with baseball.
Okay, Josh, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate
it. Absolutely, thank you.
Josh Remington is the Assistant Marketing Manager, or rather Director, for ISU Athletics. You're listening to the great mandolinist Sam Bush, his version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews and stories you heard today thanks to Colleen Reynolds, Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and Charlie Schlenker at our website, WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can share your comments about the show, or go to Facebook.com/WGLTFM to post your thoughts, or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.